Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, and my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed. Each week at this time, we introduce you to people from around Northumberland involved with the world of books and writing. This week, as it is the holiday season, we thought we would bring you our own Word on the Hills Christmas gift, a few heartwarming holiday stories and poems from local writers and beyond. So curl up next to your fire, grab a mug of something to warm your heart, relax, and listen. Felicity, let's start with a story that you wrote, and which I was privileged to hear for the first time at a Christmas celebration in Grafton. I believe that the story is a true story from your childhood. Is that right?
Yes, indeed it is. It's called One Dark Night, and it happened a few days before Christmas in, I think, 1943 or so. Evening seeped into the street with the persistent rain. By 4:30, we'd drawn blackout curtains tight against the dark. It was a miserable grey world out there, growing rapidly blacker as night squatted down over the village and the city below the hill. We shut it out, smothering the drone of planes. Later, no doubt, a siren's scream would cut the foggy atmosphere. Colour would flame an ominous scarlet as bombs hit the centre of the city and the docks. While searchlights cast up white ribbons to fan the sky, the clacking of AK-AT guns would puncture the night again and again. Inside, the lamplight cast a cosy glow across the dining room's brown carpet, brown leather sofa, and even over the faded velvet curtain covering the monstrous Morrison air raid shelter that we used as a table. A couple of days before Christmas, after we'd eaten tea and listened to Children's Hour, my mother, as usual, turned down the sound on the radio to a whisper. "Here," she said, handing us a packet of Happy Families. "This is your favourite game, isn't it? Play it quietly over there on the rug, and don't squabble." We settled on the floor. Then she crept back to the fire and sat with her ear to the woven panel of the radio, perched on top of the bookcase, to listen to the news. We were used to this ritual by now, sometimes watching her as she swallowed nervously and knit her hands together until her knuckles shone hard and white. Since my sister was still only 3, despite her frequent reminders to me that she was almost 4, and I bossy in my 6-year-old way, the game nearly always ended in arguments or tears. But that night it was interrupted by the sharp pinging of a bell. This was such an unusual occurrence that, amazed by the unfamiliar sound, we looked up at the windows first. "Is that the blackout man?" blurted my sister. "Are we in trouble? Can he see a light at our house?" My mother shook her head. "It's someone at the front door. You girls go and answer it." I looked at her in astonishment. I didn't think I was brave enough to do any such thing. And why was she sending us out there into the dark hall? There might be all kinds of dangers beyond the lighted circle in which we sprawled, the cards spread out around us. She was normally alert to so many possible hazards that we were allowed to do very little without her hovering supervision. "Up you get," she said, as she pulled us from the floor. Reluctantly, we edged into the hall, her hands prodding our back, our slippers sliding on the polished linoleum, so that we fetched up in a fused heap on the doormat. My sister was leaning drunkenly against my side. Desperately seeking a reprieve, I turned my head and looked at my mother standing in the square of light that had escaped from the dining room. She nodded at me. Slowly I reached up, turned the Yale lock over, and opened the door. A huge figure filled the space, so tall and loaded with parcels that for a moment I thought he wouldn't be able to negotiate an entry. My sister clutched at my sleeve, her panicky fingers pinching my arm. The man spoke to us, but his eyes were on my mother. "Hello, girls," he said, and smiled. "Are you Father Christmas?" I whispered. "No, I think you must have forgotten your daddy." And perhaps we had. We hadn't seen him for over a year. "Daddy, Daddy," I shouted as we pressed up against him. Uncertainly, Sally echoed my cries. I knew we'd missed him, even if we didn't recognize this person. "Let me in. It's cold out here. I've brought you a Christmas present." He stepped into the dim hall, shut the door behind him, and dropped most of his bags on the floor. "Now," he said, still holding tightly to the handles of a pale straw object that looked like a coolie's hat folded in half, "I have something here I think you'll like. Stand back and let the dog see the rabbit." There were no rabbits about that we knew of, but perhaps we did look like small animals mesmerized by a sudden beam of light. Had my mother turned on the never-used hall lamp? Dad, the conjurer, put his hand into the basket and brought out, what was it? We stopped breathing. He held out a handful of beige hair speckled with grey. Half hidden in the mass, a pair of very bright black eyes regarded us. As Dad set the puppy down on the linoleum, we dropped to the floor in ecstasy, while he stepped over our heads and pulled my mother into a long embrace.
Thank you, Felicity. I love that story. And it certainly underlines the true treasures that we do receive at Christmas, not the fancy presents tied with ribbons, but family and love and unexpected things. And here's another story that reminds us of another important thing in life, kindness, and shows how the holiday spirit can show itself in very unusual ways. The story is called Pay It Forward and is written by a young Canadian writer, Alison Carlene Hodgins. Every fast food employee knows that the drive-thru window is the worst position. Perched at the frost-covered glass, a fierce wind spits mercilessly in your face. You press the headset closer to your ear and repeat the order perfectly, only to be greeted with a harsh, "What? Isn't this Timmy's?" I glared at my Starbucks supervisor every time she handed me the headset. On the early morning shift, the headlights of pickup trucks blinded me as workers sped through in a rush to their well-paying jobs. I frothed milk and ground espresso for minimum wage. I wasn't bitter. I'd loved my job. But I hated that drive-through window. It was a freezing Tuesday afternoon when everything changed. Every once in a while, sub-zero temperatures seal a vehicle's windows shut. Drivers don't exactly enjoy having to stand outside in the cold, screaming their orders into a speaker box, when they had expected to cruise through on their heated leather seats. At such times, most customers tend to take out their frustration on the employees. But this woman was different. "I'll get the next car's order as well," she said, as she came up to the window to pay. She stood outside, gathering snowflakes on her hair and eyelashes. Though she was obviously freezing, her bright smile lit up her face like a fire. You can't take out their drinks," I said, confused and fatigued. My breath evaporated into a dense fog around my face. The lady laughed, her chubby cheeks turning crimson with cold. No, I'll buy them," she said. "Pay it forward and all that." Completely dumbfounded, I charged her as requested, and when the next customer arrived at the window, I explained what had just happened. I watched as his expression changed like a succession of photographs on a choppy slideshow. First enraged to be out in the cold, then surprised at the random act of kindness, and finally delighted by his luck. "I suppose I'll pay for the next order then," he said, nodding and waving at the impatient driver behind him. He handed over the cash and received his prepaid beverage. The trend continued throughout the entire rush. Customers arrived annoyed and hasty, only to leave humbled and calm. No one had any idea how many beverages they would have to purchase. Some customers were shocked to spend much more than they had anticipated, while others ended up receiving their order for less than half the price. 5 cars passed, then 10, then 20. No one refused to pay. Customers stood at my window, emptying a fistful of change to buy coffee for a complete stranger. Cars rounded the bend as they drove off, honking and waving their anonymous gratitude, knowing that they would likely never see each other again. Every fast food employee knows that that drive-through window is the worst position. The window sticks with constant ice, the roar of engine injures your ears, your words are lost in the howling wind. But it only takes one customer, one person, to change the entire flow of traffic. It takes one moment, one smile, to warm up even the coldest of days.
That's a lovely story. I would like to read a poem written a long time ago now, which also deals with the cold of winter. And this poem, too, is about a journey. This time, The Journey of the Magi, and it's by T.S. Eliot. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men, cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out, and the lack of shelters, and the cities hostile, and the towns unfriendly. And the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness, and three trees on the low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued, and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again, but set down this. We were led all that way for birth or death. There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here, in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death.
Well, I haven't read or heard that poem in many, many years. It's beautiful. Thanks for reading it. And now I think we'll take a short break.